32, 66 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today. The first, in honor of Halloween, is a brief author interview talking about an intriguing and entertaining new book called Go to Hell, which talks about some of the most otherworldly places on Earth. After that, we'll be previewing two orchestra concerts coming up this weekend, one by the Racine Symphony Orchestra, the other by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Here's part one of today's program. And with Halloween right around the corner, we are going to be having some fun in this portion of WGTD's morning show with Erica Engelhaupt, who is responsible for a wonderful new book from National Geographic, which is called Go to Hell, A Traveler's Guide to Earth's Most Otherworldly Destinations. Early in the book, she makes reference to really the heart and soul of this book, that is, a celebration of an exploration of places on Earth so strange that the only word for them is otherworldly. And in particular, maybe places that we could actually call underworldly, if you will, because they have sort of a hellish appearance to them. And in some cases, we're talking about real-life tragedy that kind of informs the special, if terrible, allure of certain places. And we are all around the planet as we visit 50 places in all. And I'm very excited to have a few minutes to speak with Erica Engelhaupt about this book, which again is called Go to Hell, A Traveler's Guide to Earth's Most Otherworldly Destinations. Erica Engelhaupt, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So tell us, if you can, whose interesting idea it was for this to be done, for a book like this to be put together.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was really a collaboration with myself and my editors at National Geographic. I was actually working at National Geographic as an editor several years ago, and I learned about so many amazing places around the world. And I started to realize that all these different cultures around the world have legends and stories and places that are special to them that they are interested in as an underworld or a hell or some kind of otherworldly realm. And often these have natural features like caves or volcanoes or water that are seen as entrances to hell or that have inspired what people imagine the underworld to be like. So I just realized this is a really great way to tour the world. And as I started researching the book, I found so many places. It was amazing to see how many different cultures have some kind of idea of an underworld. So I realized this was a great way to tour the world and started putting together places. I put them into kind of three categories of places I call portals to hell, which are linked to legends and lore, hells on earth, which have hellish features, and otherworldly destinations, which includes places that are eerie or strange, and just that, otherworldly.
I think it's a brilliant idea, and I absolutely love it. And, of course, one of the great things about this particular project is you, in putting it together, you could draw upon the extraordinary legacy of National Geographic, which, of course, for more than a century has been about the business of exploring the farthest reaches of our planet. And so in some respects, this is in the heart and soul of the mission of National Geographic.
It really is. And, you know, when you hear a title like Go to Hell, you might not think that. But really, what I discovered was that as you start looking at these places around the world, looking at it through the lens of people's, cultural history and their legends and lore about an underworld or a hell, it really gives you a very interesting lens to see the world, and you get to explore the history. There's so many interesting historical stories and legends. You get to explore the history, the cultures, and the places, you know, the natural features that were so incredible that they inspired wonder and awe, or in some cases, outright terror.
Mm. I wonder if we could spend a few minutes talking about the very sad story of Herculaneum. Some of our listeners will know something of this story, even if they don't recognize the name Herculaneum.
Yes, you might have heard of its more famous neighbor, Pompeii. And so this is in Italy, near Naples, Italy. And Pompeii, of course, was destroyed by a volcanic eruption, and Herculaneum was a nearby city that was actually very wealthy. It was kind of a vacation destination, really, of those times. And we're talking way back in like 79 AD. And Herculaneum really was completely destroyed when Mount Vesuvius erupted. And so you can actually go there now. They had to essentially ship the remnants of this city out of hardened lava. So it was like rock. But it really perfectly preserved many elements of the city. So you can go in and see exactly how houses were. And they were very luxurious houses with very elaborate mosaics and frescoes. And sadly, you can also see, the examples of bodies that were kind of frozen in time, just as they were, just as they fell, when this horrible cloud of, boiling hot ash, and gases just overwhelmed the city when that volcano erupted.
Talk about hell on earth. I mean, really.
It was really hell on earth. And so that was why I really wanted to include that in the book, because it really is an example of hell coming to earth. And you just have to imagine what the people would have thought at that time. You know, this was Roman civilization, and people would have been, worshiping the Roman gods. And what must they have thought when this, terrible cloud, came boiling toward their city?
Right.
So that's one that's really, it's horrific, but it's also today really fascinating and a really good way to get a look at history through that lens of a hell on earth.
Absolutely. And I think you do a marvelous job of, in a sense, putting us in that time and place. I want to have you spend just a minute or so talking about a certain crater called the Gates of Hell crater.
Yes.
In Turkmenistan. This was actually something I didn't know anything about until I explored your book. And of all of the things in the book, this is maybe at the top of the list of something I would love to see with my own eyes someday. Explain to our listeners what the Gates of Hell crater is.
Yes, it's really incredible. So you have to imagine in the middle of a desert in Turkmenistan, so there's nothing around, and then all of a sudden there's just a 230-foot wide deep hole in the ground that's on fire, and it's just flames basically shooting out of it. So if you look at it from above, it really does look like the entrance to hell, like someone has just punched a hole through the ceiling of hell, and you're looking down on it. And there are different ideas about exactly when it began, but we know that it's been burning for at least more than 50 years. And most likely what happened was that during oil and gas exploration in that area, that a natural gas seep got ignited. And it's just got so much natural gas under it that it just keeps burning and burning and burning.
It's an incredible book, and of course, sometimes it's great stories, and it's sometimes amazing images, and sometimes it is both that will give us something exceptionally compelling. In our last couple of minutes, why don't you choose something that you especially enjoy from this book, again, titled Go to Hell?
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, for in honor of Halloween, I would say one of my favorite places in the book that I got to go visit was a cave in Ireland called Onagat. And this cave is actually one of the places where Halloween was born. And it was incredible. So you can go there, and it just looks like this little unassuming hole in the ground. And you climb in, and it opens up into this pitch black crack in the earth. And in pre-Christian Ireland, the cave was believed to be a portal to the other world called Tírnanog. And this was a land of supernatural beings, such as the Sidhe, which are some of what we call fairies today. And on the festival day called Samhain, it was thought that this portal to the other world would open up and the spirits and the Sidhe would emerge and usher in the beginning of winter. And when Christians arrived in Ireland, this festival of Samhain became Halloween, and the cave became known as the Hell Cave. So today you can go and actually see the archaeological sites at a place called Rathcron, and even go inside that Hell Cave and see ancient inscriptions inside and learn all about the history, the ancient Irish history of that place. It's really cool.
Yeah, that is an amazing thing. And of course, essentially it being the birthplace of Halloween, it makes it quite extraordinary. We've mostly been talking about places in the far reaches of our planet, but we should let people know that there are a few places, including Hell, Michigan, that are right here in the good old U.S. of A, that are also part of this extraordinary tour. The book, again, titled Go to Hell, A Traveler's Guide to Earth's Most Otherworldly Destinations. It comes to us from the good folks at National Geographic. The author, Erica Engelhaupt. Erica Engelhaupt, thank you so much. What a great idea for a book, and that idea is executed really, really well. And I hope a lot of people will seek this out and enjoy this book. And thank you for being my morning show guest.
Thank you so much, and I hope people have gotten a little taste of hell.
Listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the irresistible music of Mozart from the last of his 41 symphonies, the symphony number 41 in C major, Terkel 551, known as the Jupiter Symphony. And this is one of the works that is going to be featured on tomorrow night's concert by the Racine Symphony Orchestra, a concert called Fall Masterworks, Mind, Body, and Soul. and it will include works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Tchaikovsky. And I'm very, very happy to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Pasquale Larino, who is the artistic director, conductor of the Racine Symphony Orchestra. He will be on the podium leading the musicians in this concert, which is tomorrow evening, 7:30 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, one of the loveliest spaces in which to enjoy music. And Pasquale Larino, we welcome you back to the morning show.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks, Chris.
I'm glad we can have this conversation about what is certainly an intriguing program, and I love the title in particular. Tell us more about your thinking in putting this particular program together.
Well, I think, as in all programs, a little bit like all meals, you want to have a balance and variety. I think this program offers that in spades. We have probably the finest example of Mozart, the creative genius who put the capstone on the classical period in his Jupiter Symphony. And then to the 19th century, we have one of the most beloved composers of the 19th century in Tchaikovsky's music, the Beautiful Serenade for Strings, and then moving to the 20th century, having the neoclassic of using the template of Mozart's style, but in a very new way in Stravinsky's music, certainly one of the most important composers, if not the most important composer of the 20th century.
That is a really nice progression, and it's interesting that it, in a sense, doesn't happen more often. I mean, that feels like a really fresh approach, and I really love the way this evening is put together. Since I played a little of the Mozart Symphony 41, maybe we could give you a chance to talk about, first of all, Mr. Mozart in general, but especially the legacy of his amazing symphonies and what he did in terms of helping to really bring this then rather new musical form to full fruition in such an amazing way.
Yes, I think that, you know, much of Mozart's symphonic output, and certainly he had great contributions in opera, most notably in chamber music, certainly in the concerto repertoire, particularly the piano concerto repertoire. These were real innovations of his. Symphonically, they tend to move in a steady progression, but nothing absolutely earth-shattering. I think that we get in the Mozart Jupiter Symphony really the apotheosis of his symphonic output. He sort of saved the best for last, and although he had no way of knowing that this would be his last symphony, when we get to this last movement where he combines so many elements and in such a brilliant, masterful way, recalling the complexities of counterpoint of no less than Johann Sebastian Bach. It is something that just every time I hear it or work on this piece, it just gives me pause.
Hmm. I think one assumption, careless and incorrect assumption that sometimes gets made is playing Mozart is relatively simple compared to tackling maybe other kinds of longer symphonies, maybe more complicated symphonies by later composers. And I suspect as someone who has conducted a great deal of Mozart, you would certainly take issue with that assumption, that there are some very, very stiff challenges as well as incredibly rich artistic pleasures to be found when you tackle something like the Jupiter Symphony.
Indeed, I couldn't disagree more with the assessment that Mozart is somehow easier to play. In a way, it is among the hardest difficult music to play, in that compositionally it is perfect. So it's a little bit like handling fine china. The only thing that you can do is mess it up or put your fingerprints on it or perhaps even break it. Although the music certainly has its vigorous moments, its exciting moments, but it is so beautifully crafted that if in the wrong hands, it can oftentimes break down, and it shows any miscalculation or error on the performer's part. I think some of the finest instrumentalists out there always find Mozart to be the supreme challenge.
Hmm. In your long career, out of Mozart's 41 symphonies, any idea how many of them you have had the pleasure of conducting?
I would say that I've probably done a third of the symphonies, and that's not enough. So I'm looking forward to doing enough. Although certainly it is tough to top this particular one, but yet there are miracles in so many of them that the list is still skewed to the more of them that I haven't done that I have. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to look forward to.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in this portion of the morning show with Pasquale Lorino, who is artistic director and conductor of the Racine Symphony, and their concert tomorrow night at First Presbyterian Church at 7:30 p.m. includes this magnificent symphony by Mozart, the last of his 41 symphonies, known as the Jupiter. You made mention of a work from the 20th century that is on tomorrow night's program. This is, I would venture to say, the least known of the three masterworks that are on this program. Tell our listeners more about Igor Stravinsky's Concerto in D.
Well, the Concerto in D is written for string orchestra, and you normally associate a concerto being one that features an individual instrument, highlighting their virtuosity. In that Stravinsky titles this Concerto in D, he's really referencing the virtuosity necessary by all of the instrumentalists involved in the orchestra, a concerto for orchestra, in this case, a string orchestra.
Of course, there'll be some who hear the two words 20th century, or maybe hear the name Stravinsky, and might wonder just how modern is this going to be? Is this going to be music that is, in a sense, disagreeable to the ear? And I have a feeling you very much want to reassure listeners that there are all kinds of pleasures to be had in this beautifully crafted score.
Indeed. Stravinsky, of course, came onto the world very early in his career, a bit of an enfant terrible in his great early ballet works, creating such a fervor, particularly with his Rite of Spring, that it caused riot, although that was much a part of the choreography as it was the music. But the music still remains quite revolutionary. Stravinsky then steps back from this rather acerbic style, and he adopted during his middle period a neoclassic form, going back to the earlier examples. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to juxtapose this Stravinsky work with the Mozart Symphony, to show the prototype that what Stravinsky was working with. He, and the fact that he clearly knows all the rules and then very consciously breaks many of them in executing this work and having our ear be tweaked in engaging us in ways that perhaps Mozart could never have dreamed of. But yet I think that Mozart or anyone in the classical period would certainly recognize the template.
We finally need to talk about Russian composer Peter Tchaikovsky and a work that I think a whole lot of people regard as one of his masterworks, although it's probably fair to say that when we think of Tchaikovsky masterworks, we think first of several of the symphonies and several of the ballet scores and several of his concertos, and the Serenade for Strings is perhaps something that does not always gain our full appreciation and attention the way that it really deserves.
Well, I think that Tchaikovsky was somehow almost incapable of writing anything that wasn't exceedingly beautiful, but this work is definitely a nod to the works of Mozart. For instance, he was in the first movement, he definitely was referencing maybe the most famous serenade that exists in all of music, the Mozart Eine kleine Nachtmusik, and entitling this work for strings, the serenade for strings, it is a bit of a nod to his hero, Mozart, in that respect. Within the piece, we also have a waltz. Tchaikovsky obviously is maybe most famous for his ballets, as you mentioned, and we have a beautiful, enchanting waltz which your own mental choreography can play with as the piece goes on. A lovely elegy in the third movement. I think exhibits Tchaikovsky at his most heartfelt, and then referencing and fun, and also masterfully incorporating two folk melodies into the last movement finale. It has a rousing finish.
I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the beautiful space in which you will be playing tomorrow night's concert. And of course, the Racine Symphony has certainly played there before, but I always think it merits mention. That is this lovely space, the sanctuary of First Presbyterian Church, where I've had the pleasure of performing any number of times, and as an audience member have enjoyed so many beautiful performances by the Racine Symphony and other groups. Can you just maybe describe what that space feels like for you and the symphony to play in?
Well, I think it is one of those spaces. I absolutely agree. It's a very special place to play for the orchestra. It is the place that I performed my first concerts with the orchestra as a guest, and then continuing into my tenure as music director. So it holds a special place in my heart. It is one that is as acoustically perfect an environment as I can imagine for the size ensemble that we're using. It's oftentimes true in churches that the sound can be boomy and sound gets a little bit distorted. Other places that you play are maybe too dry to be able to appreciate the lushness of much of this music. And this performing space is just the perfect balance. It is also the perfect size so that the audience members feel that they're not removed from the performers. They're right, that we're breathing the same air as the players. And I think that creates a special synergy between performer and audience that is it's just the right balance in this space at First Presbyterian.
Very good. Once again, the concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra Fall Masterworks, Mind, Body, and Soul, will be tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. in the sanctuary of First Presbyterian Church. The group playing Mozart's Symphony No. 41, Stravinsky's Concerto in D, and Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings. And you can go to racinesymphony.org for more ticket information or purchase them at the door. And on the podium for tomorrow night's concert, Maestro Pasquale Lorino. Maestro, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much, and we wish you and all of your musicians only the very best with tomorrow night's concert and all of the performances to follow.
Thank you so much, Greg.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That lovely music is by Russian composer Peter Tchaikovsky. and it is from his Symphony No. 6 in B minor, his Opus 74, known affectionately as the Pathétique. And this is one of the works that is going to be performed Saturday evening in a concert by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, 7 p.m. at Calvary Community Church. And there'll be actually much more than this beautiful symphony by Tchaikovsky on the program. And here to talk about it is the gentleman who will once again be on the podium leading the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, their music director, David Anderson. Maestro David Anderson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation, and I'm excited about the whole evening in terms of all of the music that is part of the program. It's just packed from top to bottom with one lovely work after another, plus, of course, you have a distinguished soloist that we'll talk about in just a little bit. Maybe we could just hear first how you went about putting together Saturday night's program. What were you kind of thinking about in terms of the elements to put together?
Well, the Sixth Symphony by Tchaikovsky is one of these bucket list pieces for musicians, probably any musician, any orchestral musician, and it's been in our would like to perform list for a long time, and so we knew that this was a great opportunity to play it. It happens to be right now, and so we are so excited to play that particular piece. So that's kind of the centerpiece of the program, of course. And because the Sixth Symphony, it's not like other symphonies where you have this really big ending of the fourth movement. The fourth movement is much different. It's slower. There's sadness involved in the fourth movement, and it just kind of fades away. And so we decided, instead of putting the big symphony in the second half of the program, that we're going to put it in the first half of the program. So it's kind of like we're getting a very large main course of, like, if you're thinking about a meal analogy, you're getting your large course at the very beginning. Then we'll have an intermission, and then the second half will kind of be the desserts. There's shorter pieces, great music, as you said. So we'll do the Humperdinck Hansel and Gretel overture, and then we'll bring out our soloist Andrew Swords for Vinyasky's Legend and Sarasate's Zigeunerweisen.
It's a really nice way to put things together. And first of all, it kind of makes you realize that so often conductors and music directors and so on don't even think about kind of venturing out of the tried and true formula that you start with an overture, then you have a concerto, then you have intermission, and then you have a symphony. And once in a while, although quite often, that works just wonderfully, but there are times when it makes sense to shake up that formula, and it sounds like you've done so very, very thoughtfully.
We hope it works. We hope that the audience enjoys the way that this program is, you know, ordered for this concert.
You said that the Tchaikovsky Sixth Symphony is something that's been, in a sense, on your bucket list, something you've wanted to conduct for a long time. Is there anything in particular that prompted you to program it now? I mean, is it maybe a work you feel like the orchestra is ready to play, or that you are ready to conduct, or that the world is ready to hear? I mean, or is it just, it's time?
Well, I think all of those answers are correct. When you ask if I'm ready to conduct and if we're ready to play, I don't know if anybody is ever ready to perform Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. There's a lot musically, technically, and then emotionally, just, are we ready to go through this journey together? And it is a lot. But, you know, it's interesting. There's a very practical reason why we kind of waited this long to do Tchaikovsky's Six. And that is, a couple of seasons ago, we did the full Tchaikovsky Nutcracker. And so we didn't want to do Tchaik Six on the same season as Nutcracker. And then we didn't want to do it like in the season following. So we wanted to put a little bit of distance so there isn't too much Tchaikovsky. Even though Tchaikovsky is a wonderful composer with wonderful music and wonderful melodies, we did want to, you know, kind of pace our own Tchaikovsky playing.
Right. Well, and that reminds me of the fact that the Lake Geneva Symphony not terribly long ago completed its traversal of all the symphonies of Beethoven, if I'm not mistaken.
And yes, we did. In 2019, we did it. We finished that off with Beethoven 9.
So you obviously are someone who thinks expansively in the sense of kind of the arc of development and from season to season. It's not just from concert to concert, but it sounds like you're thinking of a bigger musical and artistic picture for the Lake Geneva Symphony and its musicians and its audience, for that matter.
Yes, absolutely. I mentioned the meal analogy. It is kind of like a diet. For each concert has to have sort of the right kinds of things, the right kind of dishes, I guess. But that also goes over the course of the season and many seasons when you put them together. You know, there are some orchestras, some of the larger orchestras like Chicago Symphony or Milwaukee Symphony, when they're playing more frequently, they just get to play more music. And so whenever we do three or four or five concerts a year, we have to be very, very thoughtful about each particular concert. And I think also by doing so, we're able to make, each one of these fewer concerts is sort of a big event on its own. And so it's like, okay, there's only five times where we're going to be able to hear sort of a classical concert by the Lake Geneva Symphony. So we want to make sure that we don't miss any of them. And one of the things I've been telling the orchestra, when we're trying to get the word out about this concert, is every single person you meet, whether they're a classical music fan or not, every single person wants to hear Chike 6. Mm-hmm. It's just up to you to tell them they want to hear Chike 6. And once we get them into the concert hall, in this this case a church venue, I don't think anybody is going to leave disappointed, because this is such great music.
It really is a tremendously rich symphony in so many different ways. And what I think is also important to say is, although it bears a nickname that points to kind of the more sort of sorrowful side of its emotionality, that there is also all kinds of life and vitality and joy in this symphony. It really takes us on something of an emotional journey, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you played the second movement at the very beginning of this segment, and this is one great example. It's much lighter in that particular movement. Mahler said a symphony must contain the world, and he was talking about his own symphonies. But I think you could say that about this piece as well. Every emotion that you experience in life, you're probably going to feel in this symphony.
Hmm. Before we get to the works for violin, I do want to give you a chance to also talk about the exquisite prelude to Engelbert Humperdinck's mm-hmm. opera Hansel and Gretel. It always seems to me that everybody loves this opera, but I don't think that means people necessarily fully appreciate its greatness. I mean, even though it is, of course, a story that's really earmarked for children, I suppose, and the opera to some extent, I mean, this is just magnificently crafted music, and the prelude especially so.
Absolutely. I mean, these are Humperdinck kind of gives us foreshadowing, Some of the operas, whenever they have overtures, some of those themes don't ever come back. But for this one, it certainly does. So it's not like a summary of the opera, but he's giving you several of the main themes that you're going to hear. And I suspect that even if people if they arrive to this concert and they think they may not know any of this music, once they hear some of these themes, they'll think, oh, yeah, that's what this is from. This is from Hansel and Gretel. Because these melodies are just so great, and they're so, on the one hand, very simple. They're supposed to be about, this fairy tale. But at the same time, you have these very thick textures that Humperdinck will use, especially towards the middle and the ending of this movement. He was influenced a lot by Wagner. And so you have this very interesting dichotomy of these simple melodies plus these thicker textures.
Mm. Well, let's talk about this violinist who is also going to be joining you for Saturday night's concert. And for those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Anderson, who will be conducting the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra in their concert this Saturday evening, November 2nd, 7 p.m. at Calvary Community Church. And the concert, which begins with Tchaikovsky 6, and will also include the exquisite prelude to Hansel and Gretel, finishes out with some dazzling violin showcases. Tell our listeners about the music and about the master musician who will be playing them.
Yes, Andrew Sword is a very, very talented violinist, and it's. I think people are really, really going to have a great time listening to him. We've paired a couple of shorter violin, sort of show pieces. The first, this Wieniawski Legend. It shows off more of the lyrical side of the instrument, and then the Sarasate, the Ziegler Weisen. This is a very, it ends very, very fast. There's just a lot of fireworks, and this is one of those pieces where you go to the concert and you're just in awe of the music, you know, coming out of the violin, but also just what it takes technically to you know, make all this work. And so it's that, you know, I think about the Olympics a few months ago that we were all sort of captivated by the gymnasts and some of these really feats of athleticism. The same thing is going to happen with Andrew Swords, with in particular the Sarasate Ziegler Weisen.
Tell us the pleasure and challenge that comes with this aspect of what you do, that is collaborating with a soloist and getting everything to sync together as perfectly as possible, that is you, orchestra, and violinist.
Right, this is one of the very important things that we do, this collaboration. And a lot of times we try to find people either in the orchestra or outside of the orchestra to come in to sort of be the soloist before the soloist arrives, so that helps us learn the solo part. It's kind of strange rehearsing these pieces without the solo part, so without the most important part of the piece. And so we try to, you know, just sort of get used to the part. But then once the soloist comes in, you know, this is a wonderful thing. Now all the parts are being covered. The most important part is being covered. But what we've discovered is somebody really talented like Andrew Swords. His very, very high level of playing helps us play better. And so this is just an important development for us, but it's also just a lot of fun for us and the audience.
Wonderful. Before we let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the folks who play in the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. This, in and of itself, is a great story.
The people in the Lake Geneva Symphony are volunteer musicians. They have other, you know, other careers. You know, people like, you know, lawyers, and you know, people who are in education. We do have a good number of music educators, but from all walks of life, you know, accountants and business people and business owners and tech people. They're at a very high level, and we draw a wide geographic area. There's of course a lot of people in the Lake Geneva area, but also there's people who come from Elgin and St. Charles and from Rockford and from Milwaukee and from Madison. And so all over they come. We meet every Thursday night, and we just make this great music together. It's this wonderful experience, and it's a wonderful community of musicians.
So the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra is in concert this Saturday evening, 7 p.m. at Calvary Community Church. And if people are interested in tickets for Saturday night's concert, what should they do?
Just go to lakegenevaorchestra.org, and there's a ticket link right there. You can also get tickets at the door. Come early in case we sell out.
Very good. And on the podium, David Anderson. David Anderson, thank you so much. It was great to reconnect with you. Best wishes to you and all of your musicians with Saturday evening's concert.
Thank you so much, Greg. Have a good day.
And to finish out the Thursday morning show here on WGTD, here is a portion of one of the works that will be played on this program Saturday evening by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Here are the closing minutes of the radiant and exquisitely crafted overture to the opera Hansel and Gretel by Engelbert Humperdinck. This is Herbert von Karajan leading the Berlin Philharmonic.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be learning about something else going on this weekend. Aside from all of the symphony concerts, there are also performances at the Racine Theater Guild of the great American classic Little Women. And you can hear my conversation with Lisa Konetsky, a former member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who is the guest director for this production, which opened last weekend and runs for the next two weekends. Also, we'll be hearing about a special concert coming up at St. Mary's Lutheran Church in Kenosha this Sunday afternoon in celebration of that congregation's 150th anniversary. We'll talk with Pastor Debbie Hartfield and also with Dr. Richard Tsierdzma. From WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar, Sunday afternoon will also feature a concert by the Bell City Brass Works in concert at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in the Francis Bedford Recital Hall. Our weather forecast today calls for cloudy, windy conditions and some rain this morning, a rain we have already experienced, and we're headed for a high today of 66 degrees. And our winds today gusting up to 45 miles an hour. Cloudy, windy overnight and a low of 35 degrees. By tomorrow, Friday, sunshine should return with a high of 56 degrees. Saturday should be sunny with a high of 60. Rain is likely to redevelop on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha Receive.